From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Supreme Court hears Paula Corbin Jones versus William Jefferson Clinton.
The president's strategy has been to prevent Paula Jones from being able to use judicial process to explore any of the evidence. He doesn't want to testify. He doesn't want anybody else to testify. He doesn't want to even have to file an answer saying yes or no. I was in that room with her. And he has succeeded so far in stopping everything cold. And here we have the case being litigated in the Supreme Court. The American Civil Liberties Union is on Paula Jones's side. Numerous law professors are on both sides in front of the court briefs. The women groups aren't there.
Also, more than 1 million African Americans fought in World War II. Today is the first time any of them will receive the Congressional Medal of Honor.
America has a conscience. The conscience has been awakened, and we're free again.
7 black men are going to be awarded this in one day in a very small room in the White House. This should be a national holiday for all blacks.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. According to the Washington Post, the House Ethics Committee appears headed toward a public airing of its charges against House Speaker Newt Gingrich on the eve of President Clinton's inauguration, as GOP leaders yesterday accused Democrats of leaking a tape of a telephone conference call involving the Speaker to take attention from the President's problems. Republican Congressmember Bill Paxon, a member of the House leadership, said on CNN's Late Edition that the Ethics Committee would hold televised hearings from Friday through Monday, the day of Clinton's swearing-in ceremony on the west front of the Capitol, and the House would vote Tuesday on punishing Gingrich, who last month admitted that he broke House rules. What better way to take attention away from the hearings than to hold them during the inauguration? Well, Latino activists from New York City, Philadelphia, and other cities across the eastern seaboard came to Washington over the weekend to begin what they're calling a new phase in pressuring President Clinton to pardon the 15 Puerto Rican political prisoners in federal jails across the country. The prisoners, all who support independence for Puerto Rico, are accused of trying to overthrow the U.S. government. Nilda Pimentel is one of the activists from New York City.
I think that the Puerto Rican Latino constituency is large enough, and it has become in recent years visible and vocal enough politically, not only at the community level, but also in terms of electoral politics, to the degree that any elected official, in this case Clinton, who's received more than 72% of the Latino vote, is going to listen.
The average sentence is at least 5 times what someone convicted for murder is serving. Rebels in Peru stood firm in their demands today, refusing to release 74 hostages held at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima unless the government frees hundreds of jail comrades. The Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement leader Nestor Serpa told Peruvian government negotiator Domingo Palermo in a written note yesterday to cancel a planned meeting unless he's prepared to discuss liberating MRTA prisoners. The chairman of South Korea's ruling party made a dramatic visit today to a Seoul cathedral where union leaders are sheltering from arrest as they plot the biggest strike in the nation's history. But plans for all-out stoppages starting on Tuesday appear to be wavering, with hardened union activists confessing workers were losing their appetite for confrontation. Back here at home, Morgan Stanley and Company is facing a $30 million lawsuit from 2 black employees who say white workers traded a vile racist message over the Wall Street firm's email system. This according to the Daily News today. Yolanda Owens and Edward Hutton, both analysts at the company, also charge that the firm's hiring and promotion practices discriminate against minorities who claim they make up only 1% of company employees. And 2 female Citadel cadets who charge that male students harass them and set their clothes on fire announced yesterday they will not return to the South Carolina Military College for the second semester of their freshman year. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today, the Supreme Court considers the case of Paula Corbin Jones versus President William Clinton. Paula Jones, a former secretary in the Arkansas State House, filed a lawsuit 3 years ago alleging that then Governor Clinton sexually harassed her in a Little Rock hotel room in 1991. But the case before the Supreme Court today is not about President Clinton's alleged harassment. Rather, it focuses on whether a sitting president can face civil lawsuits. Today, we're joined by Stuart Taylor. He's one of the country's most well-known legal writers. He wrote a cover story in the November issue of The American Lawyer called Her Case Against Clinton. Paula Jones' claims against President Clinton are far stronger than the media has let on and far stronger than Anita Hill's against Clarence Thomas. And it's certainly shaken up the media. Today, as the Supreme Court hears oral arguments, we welcome Stuart Taylor to Democracy Now!
Nice to be with you.
Well, why don't you tell us what changed your mind about Paula Jones? Because you, like many, admit that at first you did think she was lying.
I did think she was probably lying about what happened in the room when she was alone, by her account, with then-Governor Clinton on May 8, 1991. I always believed that, in fact, as she claims, Clinton sent his state trooper bodyguard, Danny Lee Ferguson, to ask her to come meet with Clinton alone, tell her that the president, that the then governor found her attractive, and that she was brought up to his room for purposes of some kind of a sexual overture. I think there's a lot of evidence that establishes that, including the account given by the trooper and by Paula Jones's co-worker, who was present at the time and witnessed the approach and the return. The part about which I thought she was lying, and she may still be lying, I don't know what happened, was her allegations that while she was in the room, there were a succession of sexual overtures by Clinton, ending in a very crude one in which, according to her account, he exposed himself and demanded oral sex. And also, according to her account, throughout this process, he was at one point reminding her that he was the boss of her boss, saying, I'm a good friend of Dave's. And at the end, according to her, he said, looked at her sternly and said, after being rebuffed, said, let's keep this between ourselves. You are smart. That seemed to me a little fantastic to believe. Although certainly the president has been accused of being a womanizer, and there's ample evidence of that, there haven't been a lot of women who have come along accusing him of crude, crass sexual harassment. Most of the claims have been that the women welcomed his attentions who are alleged to be linked up with him. So that's the sense in which I thought she was lying. What changed my perspective was primarily looking at the detailed evidence, talking to three of the six people who she told about this episode right away, by their accounts, within 10 minutes in one case and a couple of days in the rest of the cases, and also the sort of strategy of non-denial from the White House. The White House, or at least the president himself and his lawyers, have never denied that he had her brought to the room. They've tried to dismiss it. They've said nothing happened, but they never denied that. Bob Bennett has said the president doesn't recall meeting her. He's never denied that he did meet her. And they've never had any kind of account of what happened. They haven't confronted the evidence that makes it pretty clear he met her and explained what happened. And that strategy itself, it seems to me, adds some credence to her claims. But bottom line, I don't know what happened. I do know there are three scenarios, which I'll describe if you want, and that maybe the most plausible one is her account.
Why don't you explain the three scenarios that you could see?
Well, given that she told her two best friends, one of them a co-worker, a very detailed and emotional rendering of exactly what she says now, within 10 minutes after leaving Clinton's room in the case of Pamela Blackard, within 90 minutes after leaving Clinton's room in the case of her friend Deborah Ballantyne, and later that day to her sister Charlotte Brown, and the next day or 2 days later to her sister Lydia Cathy. There are three possibilities, it seems to me. All of these women, all five women, hatched a monstrous conspiracy at some point to lie about the president for some rather obscure reason. Why would they do that? Number two, Paula Jones hatched an amazing lie and told it with very good sort of acting effects to her childhood friend, Pamela Blackard, 10 minutes after she left the room, to her other best friend, Deborah Ballantyne, 90 minutes after, and to her sisters. Why would she do that? Now, there's one can speculate. One speculation one hears from the people close to the president off the record, when they're talking off the record, is she succumbed. She liked it, they say. But then she got worried that her boyfriend would find out, who's now her husband, and so she made up this concoction. It's possible. Is it likely? I'm not so sure.
So why don't you tell us how the media has dealt with this? You talk in your piece about how Mike Isikoff, who's at Newsweek now, is at the Washington Post, actually did a good investigation of Paul Jones, but when he tried to have it published in the Washington Post, they balked.
Yeah, Mike Isikoff in February 94, when Paul Jones first went public, went through the same process I went through late last year. And he was rather impressed, as I was, by all of these women who supported what Paula Jones said, and the trooper who supported part of what she said, although he undermines her in other ways, I should note. The Washington Post was very wary of the story, and you can understand why they would be wary of it at first. She went public at a right-wing political conference. It was very badly handled by her lawyer. She didn't seem a very credible character, at least in the circumstances in which she first emerged. And therefore, you can see why they didn't want to put this on the front page the day she went public. But here they had this great opportunity, and a great investigative reporter, Mike Isikoff, had exclusive access to all her witnesses. What did they do after he produced various, I gather, secondhand, not from him, that this has all been in journalism reviews and so forth? He produced a story that gave a lot of credence to her account and importance of her witnesses, and they sat on it, and they had it reinvestigated, and they asked him to go do more reporting, and they had other reporters doing more reporting, and they just didn't want to publish it. They weren't comfortable with it, and the only thing that ultimately got any part of it published was the hiring of Bob Bennett on the eve of the lawsuit being filed. Suddenly, they said, wow, he's hired the most expensive white-collar criminal defense lawyer in Washington. This must be serious. Suddenly, they printed a very long story by Mike Isikoff, and it was the best story printed for a long time about this case. But in the editing process and in multiple revisions, as I understand it, the quality of her evidence got less and less and less attention, and the number of details corroborating her that were attributed to her friends, which is where he really had exclusive reporting, got sort of squeezed down and farther and deeper in the story and truncated. And by the time you read it, even if you read it pretty carefully, I think you would have a far less vivid impression of the strength of her evidence from what the Washington Post published than from what Michael Isikoff knew.
So just how did Paula Jones make her case public? Because this is how President Clinton, or at least his spokespeople, have credibility when they say this is just the right wing bashing us.
Well, they've spun it masterfully, and she certainly gave them an opening because she did go public at a right wing press conference, and within a couple of months she was appearing with Pat Robertson and various other Clinton bashers, and on a superficial glance it looked political. And it was 3 years after the event and so forth and so on. But if you look step by step at what she did and when she did it, she was never going to go public. She was afraid to go public when this first happened by her account, and I think she's credible on this. She was afraid for her job. She worked for a Bill Clinton subordinate for the state of Arkansas. She was afraid no one would believe her. She told her best friends and her sisters, and she quieted down for a long time. She was never going to go public. Then her name, or her first name, surfaced in a context in the American Spectator, an account that made it look as though she had succumbed, that she wanted to be Clinton's girlfriend. This was based on the trooper's account, and he still says that, apparently. She was afraid then that she was being made to look like a tramp who was a compliant conquest of then-Governor Clinton. And by her account, she was mad. She was afraid for her reputation. She thought people she knew would read it and would recognize her as the Paula, and she wanted to do something about it. She hired a lawyer in Arkansas who really didn't know what he was doing. He met with somebody he hoped could get a message to the White House, by the count of this other guy, he never did. He drew up a contract that had something about movie deals and got Paula Jones to sign it, which looked stupid and looked opportunistic.
That said he would get a cut of the movie deals.
A cut of the movie deals, and there have never been any movie deals. And then he took her on this right-wing toot. Not because he's a right-winger. He's a yellow dog Democrat by his own account. This is Daniel Traylor, her lawyer at the time. She's not a right-winger. She's a political ignoramus by all accounts. The reason they went public at a right-wing Clinton-bashing conference was they were advised, badly in my opinion, that this was the way to get the attention of the national press. They're all going to be there, the National Conservative Political Action Committee conference, and they all were there. And they were all laughing at Paula Jones.
This was a news conference of state troopers who were going after Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, it was a several day sort of political affair, and one of the sideshows of this political affair was state troopers who were trying to publicize their claims, and there are about two of them there, but there are about five of them who said they regularly procured women for Clinton when he was governor or facilitated liaisons with longtime lovers of his. At any rate, they were trying to get publicity for her, for those troopers. Somebody said, gee, why don't you go have a press conference with the troopers and maybe you can get some publicity too. She did that. The press conference was badly handled. Her lawyer didn't let her give a full account. The reporter, people out in the gallery, reporters, people walking by were sort of laughing and tittering. It was a fiasco. And there were no favorable stories that came out of it for her except in very conservative papers. And it was ignored by most of the press and ridiculed in a little style section piece 3 days later. By the Washington Post, which talked about how all the reporters were tittering and chuckling as this sort of dog and pony show went on. That was the flavor of the piece.
So what are the specific charges that are going before the Supreme Court today?
Well, the Supreme Court is not going to hear any inquiry into what happened. She's sued for sexual harassment, defamation of character, infliction of emotional distress under various complicated legal theories. What the Supreme Court will decide is whether the suit can go forward at all until after the president leaves office. His defense has been, his initial defense, has been that he is immune to any civil litigation against him until after he leaves office because his time and energy is too important to be wasted on civil litigation.
And how do you think the Supreme Court justices will take to that argument?
Well, the lower court, the appeals court, responded by saying, among other things, the Constitution did not create a monarchy. They didn't take to it at all well, and they ruled against the president. I think the Supreme Court will be a little more receptive, maybe a lot more receptive. It's a hard case to call because they haven't ever had a case like it, and you can't sort of look at their past voting patterns. My guess is that they'll do what I think they should do, which is allow some parts of the lawsuit to go forward so that she can preserve evidence before everybody forgets what they once remembered, but probably not to force the president to go to trial while he's in office, which would be a substantial investment of his time.
But so what? I mean, if he did this, then why should he be protected?
Well, of course, they're not going to assume he did it for purposes of deciding this. The argument is, and I don't think it's a silly argument in this regard, that the president is the embodiment of the executive branch. He's on duty 24 hours a day, in a sense. Now, of course, he goes to political fundraisers and plays golf, but at any time, the phone might ring and the Russians might be invading who knows what or who knows what could be going on, and he shouldn't be sitting in a courtroom in Arkansas for 2 weeks. And I think the court may be somewhat receptive to that part of his claim. They also may be receptive to the idea that, you know, there's hundreds of judges all over the country. Cases like this could be brought in state or in federal court. Now, of course, there haven't been many, but the president shouldn't be at the beck and call of any federal judge or state judge who says, you know, I'm tired of you getting postponements for this deposition. I want you in my courtroom tomorrow morning. I don't care what your appointment in Bosnia might be.
Now, what about the women's groups? You say that they haven't taken up this case because of, well, all sorts of issues, and I'd like you to address that. But now says that you never interviewed them and that they did work behind the scenes. They contacted her lawyers, that they never called now back, and that they did issue a press release 2 years ago.
Well, I didn't interview now because I thought I didn't need to interview now to know that this case has been going on for almost 3 years, that the excuse now originally gave for their very different attitude, you know, for their approach was, well, all we ever asked for Anita Hill was a hearing. They said things like that. We just wanted her to get a fair hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they said every woman with a sexual harassment allegation ought to get a hearing. But they've never said, as far as I know, that Paula Jones ought to get a hearing. At least they've never bothered to join any of the Friend of the Court briefs or to make any public filings that I'm aware of opposing the president's systematic strategy from day one of denying Paula Jones a hearing until the next millennium.
How did the president prevent this from coming to a head until now?
Well, this is his claim of immunity. A hearing typically means a hearing on the evidence. What are the facts? The president's strategy has been to prevent Paula Jones from being able to use judicial process to explore any of the evidence. He doesn't want to testify. He doesn't want anybody else to testify. He doesn't want to even have to file an answer saying, yes or no, I was in that room with her. And he has succeeded so far in stopping everything cold. And here we have the case being litigated in the Supreme Court. The American Civil Liberties Union is on Paula Jones's side. Numerous law professors are on both sides in front of the court briefs. The women groups aren't there.
We're talking to Stuart Taylor, and he's author of a piece in The American Lawyer called Her Case Against Clinton. And we're talking about Paula Jones' claims against President Clinton. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Stuart Taylor as today the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in the case of Paula Jones versus President Clinton. In your piece, Stuart, you talk about how Paula Jones' case is actually stronger than Anita Hill's.
That's my opinion in two regards, and I'm talking about the facts, not so much legal theories and who might get more damages in a lawsuit. One regard is the allegations, I think, are more serious. Although although Anita Hill describes a course of conduct that happened over 2 years, which is more serious in that regard, what did she say Clarence Thomas did? He talked dirty to her. He talked to her about pornographic movies. He did it over and over again, and he asked for dates over and over again. Period. Never touched her. Never asked her for sex, never retaliated against her on the job for anything she did, and it's not even clear from her own account that she was very emphatic in making it clear to him that this alleged conduct was unwelcome. Bill Clinton, on the other hand, is accused of taking a state employee who worked for his subordinate, sending a state trooper who was his bodyguard to interrupt her in the performance of her job, which happened to be in a hotel room lobby at a conference where the governor was speaking at the time, having her summoned to his hotel room so that he could make a pass at her. This much, by the way, is almost clearly established by the evidence. And right there, you're arguably dealing with more serious conduct than anything Clarence Thomas was even accused of. Now, if you go the rest of the way with the Paula Jones story and you believe her account of a succession of sexual advances, each of which she rebuffed, combined with talk about her boss, combined with the ultimate crude advance of exposing himself and demanding oral sex, combined with a sort of warning to keep quiet, you are smart, let's keep this between ourselves, I think it's a lot more egregious conduct than anything Anita Hill ever dreamed of accusing Clarence Thomas of doing. I also think that her evidence is stronger in the in two senses. One, Anita Hill got caught in various revisions of the facts, let's say. She was caught in saying a number of things that weren't true. As far as I know, that's not true of of Paula Jones, at least not yet. Second, Paula Jones is corroborating witnesses, the two friends and the two sisters and the one who was there and who witnessed the approach and the return, in my opinion, are stronger support for her story than are the four or five people who give rather vague, rather glancing, rather oblique corroboration for Anita Hill's allegations.
Well, before we get to why then the media found her so much more credible, you mentioned Clarence Thomas. He is sitting on the Supreme Court right now. What is he going to do with Paula Jones' case?
Well, if he doesn't say anything during the oral argument, it won't distinguish it from most other oral arguments. Typically, at a big case, there are eight very active questioners, and Clarence Thomas just sits there and watches. Now, this is not necessarily anything wrong with him. Justice Brennan, who's a much admired, typically did the same thing. But it's very interesting to think about him and how he's going to approach this case and how he thinks about this case. And I led my article with a couple of references to, you know, what's he going to be thinking up there? And I remembered that Hillary Clinton spoke at an award luncheon for Anita Hill in 1992 and celebrated Hill for having, quote, transformed consciousness and changed history with her courageous testimony, end quote, against Clarence Thomas. So he would have, one could forgive him if he had some feelings about the Clintons in that regard, and here he has, the shoe is on the other foot, so to speak. He's sitting in judgment on Bill Clinton.
What do you think the reason is that both women's groups and also the mainstream media has treated Paula Jones the way they have? Is it because of who President Clinton is, or is it because of a class issue of who Paula Jones is?
I think it's both of those things and also some more neutral things. I mean, I think everybody almost, including me, was put off by the way in which she came public and was not disposed to sort of be very credulous of her story after this right-wing press conference and all that stuff. And she didn't come across to me as a particularly sympathetic or believable character after what little I saw of her. That was my first reaction. There, I wouldn't fault anybody else who had the same first reaction. But she was making very serious claims against the President of the United States. They weren't transparently false. A little bit of investigation of the facts would have made it clear that, in fact, he did give a speech at that hotel that day, and that, hey, maybe there's something to this. And what I would fault both the women's groups and the press for...
And that he did get a room that day.
Sure, yeah. In fact, the Clinton people originally tried to throw Mike Isikoff off by saying, oh, no, the president wasn't even in the hotel at that time. Well, Isikoff checked that out, and he was. But... What I think what the women's groups did, and to some extent the press did, was they just didn't want to hear it. They just walked away from it. They weren't interested in knowing the details. And I think in the women's group's case, it's fairly clear that they think that Bill Clinton is the best president for women's issues they've had in a long time, if not ever, that he's a lot better for them than any of the alternatives, that he's the one they're counting on to push their agenda uphill against a Republican Congress, and that they don't want to do anything that detracts from his political force. And if that means ignoring Paula Jones, and if that means, you know, don't tell me about her evidence, that seems to be their attitude.
As we wrap up, I just wanted to go back to a key point, which also seemed to turn things around for President Clinton's lawyer, Bob Bennett, and that was the issue that her lawyer said to him that she could distinguish, she could talk about markings on his private parts.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether that is alarming to Bob Bennett or not, because who knows whether she can actually do that or not, and frankly, even if she can... it's always open to the explanation that some people close to the president give that, well, she succumbed, so of course she knows what's there. I've heard it suggested by another high-level Clintonite that, well, she could have heard from those troopers what he looked like around there. He was probably buck naked in front of them all the time. I wasn't sure whether this was a joke or speculation or whether it was a strategy for explaining what may ultimately happen, but certainly if... She, in her little sealed envelope, which is somewhere in her lawyer's office, can show a physical characteristic that you or I wouldn't know about, and can get evidence that, in fact, it matches him. That sort of calls for an explanation of some kind.
Well, I was just talking to Katha Pollitt earlier, feminist writer who did come out on Paula Jones's behalf and said that women's groups should take this up. And she said, the real question is, can a sitting president pull his pants down?
And that was Stuart Taylor. He is author of a piece in the November issue of The American Lawyer on the Paula Jones case. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we thought we would go to a woman who should have an interesting comment on what's going on here. As you've heard, many women's groups have been criticized for not aggressively supporting Paula Jones. Partly it's believed because they don't want to undermine President Clinton, who is considered good or at least better than many Republicans on women's issues. So we decided to look at a similar case, that of former Senator Bob Packwood, a pro-choice lawmaker from Oregon who is considered good on women's issues by many women's groups. And we're joined by Mary Heffernan, a former lobbyist for the National Abortion Reproductive Rights Action League, and one of the more than two dozen women who accused Packwood of sexual harassment and ultimately forced him to resign. We tracked her down in Hawaii, where she and Gina Hutton, another of Packwood's victims, now run women's retreats. And we asked her this weekend if she had any advice about what should happen now in the Paula Jones case.
Support truth-telling. Support a forum where the truth can be discerned. And that I don't believe that someone who is abusing a group, such as when a man is abusing women in this way, I don't think it's helping women or women's rights. I think there's too much dissonance between their personal life and their public life, and that we, you know, we can't afford to support that.
Again, Mary Heffernan, who was one of Bob Packwood's victims. We've also heard that Bob Packwood is looking for a secretary here in Washington, D.C., and he's not having much luck. I should also say that Mary Heffernan did add that first there has to be a hearing. She does not immediately convict President Clinton, but that is the most important thing for the woman to have her day in court. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to take a look at a rare event. Today, after more than 50 years, seven African-American World War II veterans will be awarded this country's highest honor.
Buffalo soldier, dreadlock rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival. If you know your history, then you would know where you're coming from.
Buffalo Soldier, sung by Bob Marley. And today, seven African-American World War II veterans will be honored with the Congressional Medal of Honor at a White House ceremony, despite the fact that more than 1.2 million African-Americans fought in World War II. Not one black World War II veteran has ever received the nation's highest military honor. Vernon Joseph Baker will be the only living African-American veteran to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor today. He's being recognized for his heroism in April 1945 in Italy. I should say that Vernon Baker was with Company C, the 370th Infantry Regiment, 92nd Infantry Division, known as the Buffaloes. In April 1945 in Italy, when his company was stopped by concentrated fire from several enemy machine gun emplacements, he destroyed four of the machine gun nests, occupied an exposed position, and drew enemy fire, allowing his company personnel to evacuate. On the following night, Lieutenant Baker voluntarily led a battalion through enemy minefields and heavy fire. We caught up with Vernon Baker last night at a dinner in his honor at the Cosmos Club here in Washington, D.C. What do you think it says about the society that this took more than half a century?
Well, I've said it before, and America has a conscience. The conscience has been awakened, and we're free again.
Did you ever think you would see this day?
No, I never thought about it.
Lieutenant Baker had just met with General Colin Power, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I'm so very, very pleased that the nation has gotten around to righting a wrong. These seven men served their nation in combat with great distinction and valor. They were deserving of the Medal of Honor, but at that time, blacks simply were not going to get the Medal of Honor. And so it took 50 years, and it took a great deal of research, and now that right will be wrong, and I'm so very, very happy that it's happening. And I hope what the people of America will see over the next couple of days as Lieutenant Baker and his deceased colleagues are recognized is a man who represents many, many men who served with quiet dignity, who served a country that was not serving them, but nevertheless served. And I hope it will give inspiration to new generations of youngsters coming up, black and white, of what valor and service to country mean.
There are some who are quite concerned even that all seven are being awarded together, because it means there's a limitation on the number of family members that can go, and that in no other case has there been that many people sort of lumped together.
Yeah, I don't know the circumstances of the presentation or why they are doing it this way, but I'm quite sure it'll be done with dignity and with respect for each of the seven.
What do you think it says about our country even today, since it did take 50 years, so this is through the 70s and the 80s, even into the 90s, for these men to win these honors?
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case, and the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time? And it took a while to build a convincing case and to single out these seven men as being worthy of the Medal of Honor. Yes, it took a long time. It probably took too long, but what we should rejoice in is the fact that it is now happening.
General Colin Powell was there last night to honor Vernon Baker, the only living black World War II veteran to receive today's Congressional Medal of Honor. Staff Sergeant Reuben Rivers is one of the six soldiers being posthumously honored today. The reason has largely to do with the 15-year campaign waged by his white company commander. He is being awarded for extraordinary heroism, Reuben Rivers is, which took place on November 16th through 19th in 1944. Staff Sergeant Rivers' tank was hit by a mine while advancing toward Gubling, France. Severely wounded in the leg, he refused morphine and evacuation, took command of another tank, and advanced with his company. Repeatedly refusing evacuation, Sergeant Rivers continued to direct his tank's fire at enemy positions for 3 days. On the morning of the 19th of November, Sergeant Rivers opened fire on the enemy tanks, covering Company A as they withdrew. While doing so, Sergeant Rivers' tank was hit, killing him and wounding the crew. It's his white company commander, D.J. Williams, who has been fighting for this honor for more than 50 years. Again, Staff Sergeant Reuben Rivers with the 761st Tank Battalion, an all-black unit in General Patton's 3rd Army, known as the Black Panthers. Yesterday, I met up with Captain David D.J. Williams to talk to him about his more than a half a century battle. And we also talked with E.J. McConnell, an African-American veteran who fought along with Reuben Rivers. We're going to begin with Captain David D.J. Williams. I asked him first to tell me what a white commander like him was doing with an all-black unit.
In OCS, First Company Officer School at Fort Knox, there were four of us tops of the class, four college guys. So the general called us in one by one, and I was the first. He said, "How do you feel about Negroes?" So I said, "Well, Dad had one, his boyhood friend in his company. His dad was an industrialist. And I boxed black or Negro boys and the amateurs, and Joe Lewis was a hero at that time. And I had no problem." He said, "Splendid." He said, "You're going down to a Negro tank battalion. Mrs. Roosevelt has created it along with the Tuskegee Airmen. How do you feel about it?" I said, "Well, sir, I was an enlisted man for a year. I know light tanks. Why not?" So he said, "Send the others in." Three were Southerners. So they were supposed to know Negroes better than a Northerner. That was the legend anyway. So I went down to Camp Claiborne, and Dad had told me at the station, we're Celtic, Irish and Welsh. He said, "You know, son, this is a great opportunity for you. You should do something meaningful for your country. We all have a destiny." He said, "Someday that you'll know your destiny, why you got sent there, and here it is 50-some years after." So I went, and I remember my first company commander, I walked in as a young, very young lieutenant, and he said, "Boy, what you know about these folks down here?" I said, "Well, sir, not very much." He said, "Let me get you straight. You're down here with Eleanor Roosevelt's niggers. and like getting cold water over my head.
Captain Williams, you then took your men to battle in France. One of your soldiers, Reuben Rivers, was injured. He refused to take morphine, continued to fight, covered for the troops, and died. When you applied for the Congressional Medal of Honor for him, what did it take?
You know, in those days, no black man was supposed to be brave, believe me. It was hard for us. The only medal that was easy for us was the Purple Heart, killed or wounded. We got, how many of them do we get? Oh, my gosh. 50% of the battalion got Purple Hearts. So we typed it up in a muddy field. We took it back with two witnesses. And the indifference, I had an argument. I was accused of insubordination. And Rich, my driver, when we got out, Rich was with me, always kept him with me as a witness. He says, Captain, you know, if Reuben been white, his family would be in Roosevelt White House in 1 month and got the thing. I said, I know that. He's not getting it because he's a Negro. I felt that in my guts. Now, what should have happened, the colonel should have sent it to division, and I know General Paul would have okayed it because he gave Reuben Rivers a Silver Star. I know the Corps commander, and it would go to Patton, whom we called the Green Hornet, not Blood and Guts, the Green Hornet. I know he loved his heroes. He would have, a man killed in action? He would have, and then goes to Roosevelt, of course. I know it did not go through those channels.
Before we talk about the struggle for the next 50 years, can you talk about what it was like, you as a white officer with your
black company? How did the men treat you in the company?
Yes, we used to sit around, and it was some comfort. We had our own chat. The chaplains didn't come to us. We had our own. And after a guy got killed, we were very down, especially the day Rivers got it, to lose two lieutenants. And so we used to talk. We used to talk, and it was kind of childish, but we're going to have a segregated soldiers' heaven just for us. And Richardson, whom we called, but he said, we ain't even going to let General Patton in there. I said, well, what do you mean? The Hornet? You're not going to let him? He said, we want no white boys. You're the only white boy. But he said, but you ain't white. He used that horrible word, N. You one of us. I said, so well, the wives will all be meeting soldiers' heaven. And to this day, I think old Reuben's up there with Rich and all of them saying, we're waiting for the captain.
David D.J. Williams, a former company commander in the 761st Tank Battalion, will be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing with the conversation with Company Commander David D.J. Williams, commander in the 761st Tank Battalion, known as the Black Panthers, and he was the man who's fought for 50 years to get Staff Sergeant Reuben Rivers honored today, and today he is being honored at the White House. I wanted to leap ahead all the way to 1989, when it looked like you had some action in terms of getting Reuben Rivers the Congressional Medal of Honor. You had Oklahoma Senator Inhofe on your side, as well as the other senator and other people. Can you describe, though, that was in 1989. It's now 1997. What even took this last 8 years?
You haven't any idea the frustration that I went through. It went through once. The Black Caucus set me up an appointment with the Pentagon. The Black Caucus thing a couple years ago. I went over. I got the sleeves out of their vest. I mean, they took me to lunch. They couldn't find the file. I said, the secretary, what do you mean you can't find the file? I had it in a brief. I said, I'll give you another. You signed for it. Yeah, it's Pentagon. Gold plumbing, beautiful food. Please. Then I thought, what am I up against? A poor man's Don Quixote, what it amounted to. So you just keep plugging. And I wasn't going to betray these men because they all called me, the public. Oh, the New York Times busted the story, too. They put it in about it, went all over the place. The press, the media really helped. So the frustration was tremendous. You haven't any idea. Then, So I got letters from the White House, vague, and you call up. Well, he's not in right now. I'm sorry. And it was just fighting, jousting windmills, and there's nothing much you can do, a bureaucracy. So Inhofe really got, he got behind it. God bless him. And then Senator Nichols was the head of appropriation. He went to see President Clinton. So, again, it started to roll. Then the Black College Committee investigated it. I went and spoke to them, and that was it.
You talk about the bureaucracy being the problem, but isn't racism at play here?
There was racism in the 40s. The Pentagon admits that. But racism today, I can't prove that. After all, Colin Powell was chief of staff. They had black generals. But I have my opinion, which I probably shouldn't voice.
Go ahead.
I smelled racism.
Did Colin Powell help?
I don't want to comment on that. We contacted him. I don't know what he know. He did not help.
David D.J. Williams, former company commander in the 761st Tank Battalion, an all-black unit in General Patton's Third Army. And today he will be at the White House, where Reuben Rivers and seven other African-American World War II vets will be honored. Another man who'll be there is E.G. McConnell, an African-American vet who fought along with Reuben Rivers in the 761st Tank Battalion, called the Black Panthers. And E.G. McConnell talked yesterday in his hotel room in Roslyn, Virginia, as he prepared for today's event, about what it was like for black soldiers in World War II.
As the train taking us into Fort Knox chugged through the hills of Kentucky into this fort, orders came down in the train for us to pull our shades down. We were riding in a segregated train where the blacks rode in the front right behind the chugging locomotive, and in a car one and car two where we got all the fumes and noise and everything else from this thing. Orders came down for us to pull the shades down. And the guys, we were in the first two cars, pulled the shades down. I didn't realize what this was all about. I made inquiries. I got no answers. I got out between the two cars, number one and number two car, to see why we had to pull the shades down. Just my curiosity as a 16-year-old. We were going right through old hee-haw country. We saw some of these old cowboys and some of these old mountaineers waving at the train, the troop train, with their rifles. Later on, I found out they told us to pull it down for our own protection because they'd fired on these all-black cars several times in the past. Well, anyway, I took my basic training in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and then they really sent me back behind the Cotton Curtain. Russia has an Iron Curtain. America has a Cotton Curtain. Louisiana was something else. Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. Anyway, on arriving in Camp Claiborne, traveling in segregated cars because I'd come from school in Fort Knox, and not being able to even go to the dining car, traveling on government orders, I couldn't go to a dining car and be fed. Well, I got down there, and you're talking about filth and whatnot. We were stationed in the worst part of this camp in Louisiana, next to a sewage disposal pit where there was filth all over. We had tar paper huts that we lived in. If we got a package from home, usually people from home would send goodies that we enjoyed eating and whatnot. It laid into the orderly room until mail call later on in the evening. Then it was infested with roaches from the sewers and all like that.
And this was just the black units?
This was just the black units. What a disappointment I felt going into this man's army and being mistreated like this. Not being able to ride in any section of a train, not being able to ride in any part of the bus, a trolley car, or whatever. My people were from the Caribbean. They didn't know anything about segregation. I told them about this in letters that I wrote home. They couldn't understand. So I was so determined to let these people know what it was all about that I removed a white-colored sign from a streetcar in Alexandria, Louisiana, which I still have today, with a sign colored pointing towards the front of the car and white pointing towards the rear of a car. And this, incidentally, the colored was up top in this sign. It was spring-loaded so that they could fold it up when it went through an entire white area or entire black area. They could fold it up to their satisfaction. Well, anyway, we were denied all our rights. It was total segregation. We didn't have privilege of roaming all over camp because we were in the black area. As we served in Camp Hood, Texas, it's now Fort Hood, Texas, the Italian and German prisoners of war had more liberties on the post than we did. We were confined to the black area only. The German or the Italian prisoners could roam the whole damn post without guards. They could go into any PX on the post. Here recently in 1991, when I went to Europe for doing a documentary, one of these German soldiers approached as a Channel 13 WNET was filming, and this German approached and wanted to know what we were all about. When he found out that we were black soldiers serving in the discriminating army in the U.S., he says, "I was a prisoner of war. I was in Tennessee. I had more rights than you people." You talking about being angered, but I had to keep my cool, see? So that was something that really outraged me in recent years, see? Now, this 761st Tank Battalion were the original Black Panthers, unlike the Panthers of the 60s who said, "Hell no, I won't go." The majority of us were volunteers. Our unit fought for 183 consecutive days in the European theater of operation. Four major campaign ribbons we received. See? Now, up until the Spanish-American War, 31 black soldiers and 5 black seamen received the Congressional Medal of Honor. World War I and World War II, not one black serviceman received this until April 5th of 1991, when George Bush awarded the nation's highest award to a Freddie Stoa killed some 70 years prior to in World War I. World War II, till this date, not one has received it.
How many blacks served in World War II?
It was over 1 million Afro-Americans served in World War II. There were 455, I believe, 455 Congressional Medals of Honor awarded, but none ever to any blacks. You know, I'm very outspoken about this because it was so disappointing to me as a young volunteer going into something like this. Washington, D.C., may I say, was a point of segregation. Traveling from New York back to Camp Hood, Texas, I could travel any part of a train till I reached Washington, D.C., when I hit Union Station, we were the conductors or the whoever on the train came through and announced that all blacks would have to go to the first two cars in the forward part of the train. See? That's why I say up until today, my country tis of thee, O sweet land of bigotry. See?
Did you come today by train or by plane?
By train. First time I've come into Union Station since. I was amazed. I stopped. I gazed. I looked through his place. And I said, look at my country. Look what is happening today. We're progressing. Maybe we'll get there in my lifetime. Well, anyway, during our fighting in Europe, as I stated, my unit fought for 183 consecutive days through six European countries. The average lifespan of a tank battalion in combat at the time was 8 to 12 days. We never had a Red Cross coffee donut truck come up to us. I used to see them come up and serve the white troops, but not to us, see? We never had that opportunity, see? Never once did I have a shower truck. I'd like to say also, D.J. Williams, a company commander in this unit, he was loved by all the troops. This man had compassion. This man didn't have this bitterness and this staunch bigotry and all like that in him. He has fought for 53 years to get this honor to Reuben Rivers. 53 years. His monies and every damn thing else. He finally got a university convinced to do a study on blacks why they didn't receive this high award. See? I have to give it to him. He was a fighter. And here we are waiting to see this award. Some of my comrades killed in combat, the parents wouldn't even send for their bodies, knowing that blacks were not allowed to be buried in cemeteries in their hometowns next to whites. They had to be buried out in the woods, out in the fields, stuff like that. What a hurt. What a disappointment. In 1948, Harry S. Truman passed Executive Order 9981, making segregation in the U.S. forces outlawed. Thank God for that. Thank God for that. However, it wasn't until 1965 that members who fought in the 761st and other black fighting outfits were allowed to go to the polls and vote in southern states.
E.G. McConnell, you almost were not invited to this event. What did it take to get an invitation to the White House?
Well, D.J. Williams, Captain D.J. Williams, who had been fighting for 53 years for this award, was not invited to this event. He had to light fires and all like that to get an invite. Finally, he got an invite about 2 weeks ago.
Senator Inhofe.
Yeah. Anyway, he had to go to politicians, Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma, to get an invite. After that, I said to him, DJ, I'm going to fight like hell to get an invite to this thing. It was seven black men are going to be awarded this in one day in a very small room in the White House. This should be a national holiday for all blacks.
E.G. McConnell, African-American veteran who fought with Reuben Rivers in the 761st Tank Battalion, the Black Panthers. Reuben Rivers and six other men, one of them still surviving, Lieutenant Vernon Baker, will be honored today at the White House with Congressional Medals of Honor. You're listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, executive producer Julie Drizin, our engineer Kenneth Mason. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Thank you.
Standard Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes,